Eye fixed on the ambling bee, Lily walks to the bar and picks up a glass and a folded newspaper. She approaches the table, watching the bee walking around in circles. She jumps forward and lowers the glass, trapping the bee. It flies up and bumps the bottom of the glass. Lily tilts the glass, slides the folded paper underneath it, and raises her hands, holding the newspaper against the top of the glass. The camera pulls back, and we see the cowardly gambler peeking out from under the table as Lily pushes the doors open and releases the bee. Behind him, Lester Moon says, "Cheeseburger's ready, mister." For the next half hour, Jack eats his burger and tries to lose himself in the movie. The burger is great, world class, with that juicy taste you can get only from a greased-up griddle. And the fries are perfect, golden and crunchy on the outside. But his concentration keeps wandering from the terror of Deadwood Gulch. The problem is not that he has seen the movie perhaps a dozen times. The problem is Tansy Freneau. Certain things she said trouble him. The more he thinks about them, the less he understands what is going on. According to Tansy, the crow, the raven, named Gorg, came from a world alongside and outside the world we know. She had to be talking about the territories. Using a phrase from Poe's The Raven, she called this other world Night's Plutonian Shore, which was pretty good for someone like Tansy, but did not seem in any way applicable to the magical territories. Gorg had told Tansy that everything in his world was on fire, and not even the blasted lands met that description. Jack could remember the blasted lands and the odd train that had taken him and Rational Richard, then a sick, wasted Rational Richard, across that vast red desert. Strange creatures had lived there, alligator men and birds with the faces of bearded monkeys, but it had certainly not been on fire. The blasted lands were the product of some past disaster, not the site of a present conflagration. What had Tansy said? A big, big place made all of fire, going way high up. What had she seen? To what landscape had Gorg opened her eyes? It sounded like a great, burning tower, or a tall building consumed by fire. A burning tower, a burning building in a burning world. How could that world be the territories? Jack has been in the territories twice in the past 48 hours, and what he has seen has been beautiful. More than beautiful, cleansing. The deepest truth Jack knows about the territories is that they contain a kind of sacred magic, the magic he saw in Judy Marshall. Because of that magic, the territories can confer a wondrous blessing on human beings. The life of that extraordinary, tough, beloved woman making fun of Bill Towns on the big screen before him was saved by an object from the territories. Because Jack had been in the territories, and maybe because he had held the talisman, almost every horse he bets on comes in first. Every stock he buys triples in value. Every poker hand he holds takes the pot. So what world is Tansy talking about? And what's all this stuff about Gorg coming here through a burning hole? When Jack flipped over yesterday, he had sensed something unhappy, something unhealthy, far off to the southwest, and he suspected that was where he would find the fisherman's twinner. Kill the fisherman, kill the twinner. It didn't matter which he did first, the other one would weaken. But it still didn't make sense. When you travel between worlds, you just flip. You don't set a fire at the world's edge and run through it into another one. A few minutes before 12, the rumble of motorcycles drowns the voices on the screen. Mister, you might want to take off, says Moon. That's the Thunder Five, Jack says. I know. Okay. It's just they scare the shit out of some of my customers. But as long as you treat them right, they act okay. I know, there's nothing to worry about. I mean, if you buy him a beer or something, they'll think you're all right. Jack gets off his stool and faces the bartender. Lester, there's no reason to be nervous. They're coming here to meet me. Lester blinks. For the first time, Jack notices that his eyebrows are thin, curved wisps, like those of a 1920s vamp. Okay? Okay? I'd better start pouring a pitcher of Kingsland. He grabs a pitcher from beneath the bar, sets it under the Kingsland ale tap, and opens the valve. A thick stream of amber liquid rushes into the pitcher and turns to foam. The sound of the motorcycles builds to an uproar at the front of the building, then cuts off. Beezer St. Pierre bangs through the door, closely followed by Doc, Mouse, Sonny, and Kaiser Bill. They look like Vikings, and Jack is overjoyed to see them. Stinky, turn that TV the fuck off, Beezer roars. And we didn't come here to drink, so empty that pitcher into the drain. The way you pour, it's all head anyhow. And when you're done, get back in the kitchen with your mama. Our business with this man's got nothing to do with you. Okay, Beezer, Moon says in a shaky voice. All I need is a second. And that's what you got, Beezer says. Beezer and the others line up in front of the bar, some of them staring at Stinky Cheese, some more kindly at Jack. Mouse is still wearing his cornrows, and he has daubed some black anti-glare substance beneath his eyes, like a football player. Kaiser Bill and Sonny have pulled their manes back into ponytails again. Ale and foam slide out of the pitcher and seep into the drain. Okay, guys, Moon says. His footsteps retreat along the back of the bar. A door closes. The members of the Thunder Five separate and spread out in front of Jack. Most of them have crossed their arms on their chests, and muscles bulge. Jack pushes his plate to the back of the bar, stands up, and says, Before last night, had any of you guys ever heard of George Potter? From his perch on the edge of the pool table nearest to the front door, Jack faces Beezer and Doc, who lean forward on their bar stools. Kaiser Bill, one finger against his lips and his head bowed, stands beside Beezer. Mouse lies stretched out on the second pool table, propping his head up with one hand. Banging his fists together and scowling, Sonny is pacing back and forth between the bar and the jukebox. You sure he didn't say Bleak House like the Dickens novel? Mouse says. I'm sure, says Jack, reminding himself that he should not be surprised every time one of these guys demonstrates that he went to college. It was Black House. Jeez, I almost think I... Mouse shakes his head. What was the builder's name again? Asks Beezer. Burnside. First name probably Charles, sometimes known as Chummy. A long time ago he changed it from something like Beerstein. Beerstein? Bernstein? You got me, Jack says. And you think he's the fisherman? Jack nods. Beezer is staring at him as if trying to see the back of his head. How sure are you? 99%. He planted the Polaroids in Potter's room. Damn! Beezer pushes himself off his stool and walks around to the back of the bar. I want to make sure nobody forgets the obvious. He bends down and straightens up with a telephone book in one hand. Know what I mean? Beezer opens the directory on the bar, flips a few pages, flips back, and runs his thick finger down a column of names. No Burnside, too bad. Good idea, though, Jack says. This morning I tried the same thing myself. Sonny pauses on his return journey from the jukebox and jabs a finger at Jack. How long ago was this damn house built? Nearly 30 years ago, during the 70s. Well, we were all kids then, back in Illinois. How are we supposed to know about that house? You guys get around. I thought there was a pretty good chance you might have seen it. And the place is spooky. People tend to talk about houses like that. They did in normal cases, at least, Jack thought. In normal cases, spooky houses got that way because they had been empty for a couple of years, or because something terrible had happened in them. In this case, he thought, the house itself was terrible, and the people who otherwise would have talked about it could barely remember seeing it. Judging by Dale's response, Black House had vanished into its own non-existent shadow. He says, Think about this. Try to remember. In the years you've been living in French Landing, have you ever heard of a house that seemed to have a curse on it? Black House caused injuries to the people who built it. The workmen hated the place. They were afraid of it. They said you couldn't see your shadow when you got near it. They were claiming it was haunted while they worked on it. Eventually they all quit, and Burnside had to finish the job himself. It's off by itself somewhere, Doc says. Obviously, this thing isn't sitting around in plain view. It's not in some development like Libertyville. You're not going to find it on Robin Hood Lane. Right, Jack says. I should have mentioned that before. Potter told me it was built a little way off what he called the road, in a kind of clearing. So it's in the woods. Doc, you're right, it's isolated. Hey, 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 Mouse says, swinging his legs over the side of the pool table and grunting himself upright. His eyes are screwed shut, and he claps one meaty hand on his forehead. If I could only remember, he lets out a howl of frustration. What? Beezer's voice is at twice its normal volume, and the word sounds like a paving stone hitting a cement sidewalk. I know! I saw that fucking place, he says. As soon as you started talking about it, I had this feeling it sounded kind of familiar. It kept hanging at the back of my mind, but it wouldn't come out. When I tried to think about it, you know, make myself remember, I kept seeing these sparkly lights. When Jack said it was back in the woods, I knew what he was talking about. I had a clear picture of the place, surrounded by all these sparkling lights. That doesn't sound much like Black House, Jack says. Sure it does. The lights weren't really there. I just saw them. Mouse offers this observation as though it is completely rational. Sonny utters a bark of laughter, and Beezer shakes his head and says, shit. I don't get it, Jack says. Beezer looks at Jack, holds up one finger, and asks Mouse, are we talking about July, August, 2 years ago? Naturally, Mouse says. The summer of the ultimate acid. He looks at Jack and smiles. 2 years ago, we got this amazing, amazing acid. Drop a tab, you're in for 5 or 6 hours of the most unbelievable head games. Nobody ever had a bad experience with the stuff. It was all groove. Know what I mean? I suppose I can guess, Jack says. You could even do your job behind it. For sure you could drive, man. Get on your hog, go anywhere you could think of. Doing anything normal was a piece of cake. You weren't fucked up. You were operating way beyond your max. Timothy Leary wasn't all wrong, Doc says. God, that was great stuff, Mouse says. We did it until there was no more to do, and then the whole thing was over, the whole acid thing. If you couldn't get that stuff, there was no point in taking anything else. I never knew where it came from. You don't want to know where it came from, says Beezer. Trust me. So you were doing this acid when you saw Black House, Jack says. Sure. That's why I saw the lights. Very slowly, Beezer asks, where is it, Mouse? I don't exactly know. But hold on, Beezer, let me talk. That was the summer I was tight with little Nancy Hale, remember? Sure, Beezer says. That was a damn shame. He glances at Jack. Little Nancy died right after that summer. Tore me apart, Mouse says. It was like she turned allergic to air and sunlight all of a sudden. Sick all the time, rashes all over her body. She couldn't stand being outside because the light hurt her eyes. Doc couldn't figure out what was wrong with her, so we took her to the big hospital in La Riviere, but they couldn't find out what was wrong either. We talked to a couple of guys at Mayo, but they weren't any help. She died hard, man. Broke your heart to see it happen. Broke mine for sure. He falls silent for a long moment, during which he stares down at his gut and his knees, and no one else says a word. All right, Mouse finally says, raising his head. Here's what I remember. On this Saturday, little Nancy and I were tripping on the ultimate, just riding around to some places we liked. We went to the riverfront park in La Riviere, drove over to Dog Island and Lookout Point. We came back this direction and went up on the bluff. Beautiful, man. After that, we didn't feel like going home, so we just wheeled around. Little Nancy noticed this no trespassing sign I must have passed about 1,000 times before without seeing it. He looks at Jack Sawyer. I can't say for certain, but I think it was on 35. Jack nods. If we hadn't been on the ultimate, I don't think she ever would have seen that sign either. Oh, man, it's all coming back to me. What's that? She says. And I swear I had to look 2 or 3 times before I saw that sign. It was all beat up and bent with a couple of rusty bullet holes in it, sort of leaning back into the trees. Somebody wants to keep us off that road, little Nancy says. What are they hiding up there anyhow? Something like that. What road, I ask. And then I see it. It's hardly even what you could call a road. About wide enough for a car to fit in if you have a compact. Thick trees on both sides. Hell, I didn't think anything interesting was hidden up there, unless it was an old shack. Besides that, I didn't like the way it looked. He glances at Beezer. What do you mean you didn't like the way it looked? Beezer asks. I've seen you go into places you damn well knew were no good. Or are you getting mystical on me, Mouse? Call it what you fucking want. I'm telling you how it was. It was like that sign was saying, keep out if you know what's good for you. Gave me a bad feeling. On account of it was a bad place, Sonny interrupts. I've seen some bad places. They don't want you there and they let you know. Beezer shoots him a measured look and says, I don't care how evil this bad place is. If it's where the fisherman lives, I'm going there. And I'm going with you, says Mouse, but just listen. I wanted to bag it and get some fried chicken or something, which combined with the ultimate would have been like eating the food of paradise, or whatever Coleridge said. But little Nancy wanted to go in because she had the same feeling I did. She was a game broad, man. Ornery, too. So I turned in, and little Nancy's hanging on in back of me, and she's saying, don't be a pussy, Mouse, let's haul ass. So I gun it a little bit, and everything feels all weird and shit, but all I can see is this track curving away into the trees, and the shit I know isn't there. Like what? Asks Sonny, in what sounds like the spirit of scientific enquiry. These dark shapes coming up to the edge of the road and looking out through the trees. A couple of them ran toward me, but I rolled right through them like smoke. I don't know. Maybe they were smoke. Fuck that. It was the acid, Beezer says. Maybe, but it didn't feel that way. Besides, the ultimate never turned on you, remember? It wasn't about darkness. Anyhow, right before the shit hit the fan, all of a sudden I was thinking about Kiz Martin. I can remember that, all right. It was like I could practically see her right in front of me, the way she looked when they loaded her in the ambulance. Kiz Martin, Beezer says. Mouse turns to Jack. Kiz was a girl I went out with when we were all at the university. She used to beg us to let her ride with us, and one day the Kaiser said okay, she could borrow his bike. Kiz was having a ball, man. She's digging it. And then she rolls over some damn little twig, I think it was. Bigger than a twig, Doc says. A little branch, maybe 2 inches in diameter. Which is just enough to test your balance, especially if you're not used to hogs, Mouse says. She rolls over this little branch, and the bike flops over, and Kiz flies off and hits the road. My heart damn near stopped, man. I knew she was gone the second I came up close enough to see the angle of her head, says Doc. There wasn't even any point in trying CPR. We covered her with our jackets, and I rode off to call an ambulance. 10 minutes later, they were loading her in. One of the guys recognized me from my stint in the ER, or they might have given us some trouble. I wondered if you were really a doctor, Jack says. Completed my residency in surgery at UI, walked away from the whole deal right there. Doc smiles at him. Hanging around with these guys, getting into beer brewing, sounded like more fun than spending all day cutting people up. Mouse, Beezer says. Yeah. I was just getting to the curve in the little road, and it was like Kiz was standing right in front of me. It was so vivid. Her eyes closed and her head hanging like a leaf about to fall. Oh, man, I said to myself, this is not what I want to see at this particular moment. I could feel it all over again, the way I felt when Kiz hit the road. Sick dread. That's the word for it, sick dread. And we come around the curve, and I hear this dog growling somewhere off in the woods. Not just growling, growling, like 20 big dogs are out there, and they're all mad as hell. My head starts feeling like it wants to explode. And I look up ahead of me to see if a pack of wolves or something is running toward us, and it takes me a while to realize that the weird shadowy stuff I see up ahead is a house. A black house. Little Nancy is hitting me on the back and rapping my head, screaming at me to stop. Believe me, I can get with the program because the last thing I want to do is get any closer to that place. I stop the bike, and little Nancy jumps off and pukes on the side of the road. She holds her head, and she pukes some more. I'm feeling like my legs turn to rubber, like something heavy is pressing on my chest. That thing, whatever it is still going nuts in the woods, and it's getting closer. I take another look up at the end of the road, and that ugly damn house is stretching back into the woods like it's crawling into them, only it's standing still. It gets bigger the more you look at it. Then I see the spark lights floating around it, and they look dangerous. Stay away, they're telling me. Get out of here, mouse. There's another no trespassing sign leaning against the porch, and that sign, man, that sign kind of flashed, like it was saying, this time I mean it, buddy. My head is splitting in half, but I get little Nancy on the bike, and she sags against me like pure dead weight, except she's hanging on, and I kick the hog on and spin around and take off. When we get back to my place, she goes to bed and stays there for 3 days. To me, it seemed like I could hardly remember what happened. The whole thing went kind of dark in my mind. I hardly had time to think about it anyhow, because little Nancy got sick, and I had to take care of her whenever I wasn't at work. Doc gave her some stuff to get her temperature down, and she got better so we could drink beer and smoke shit and ride around like before. But she was never really the same. End of August, she started getting bad again, and I had to put her in the hospital. Second week of September, hard as she was fighting, little Nancy passed away. How big was little Nancy? Jack asks, picturing a woman roughly the size of Mouse. Little Nancy Hale was about the size and shape of Tansy Furneaux, Mouse says, looking surprised by the question. If she stood on my hand, I could lift her up with one arm. And you never talked about this with anyone, Jack says. How could I talk about it? Mouse asks. First, I was crazy with worry about little Nancy, and then it went clean out of my head. Weird shit will do that to you, man. Instead of sticking in your head, it erases itself. I know exactly what you mean, Jack says. I guess I do too, says Beezer. But I'd say that the ultimate kicked the shit out of your reality there for a while. You did see the place, though, Black House. Damn straight, says Mouse. Beezer focuses on Jack. And you say the fisherman, this creep Burnside, built it. Jack nods. So maybe he's living there and he rigged up a bunch of gadgets to scare people away. Could be. Then I think we're going to let Mouse take us over on Highway 35 and see if he can find that little road he was talking about. Are you coming with us? I can't, Jack says. I have to see someone in Arden first, someone who I think can also help us. She has another piece of the puzzle, but I can't explain it to you until I see her. This woman knows something? Oh, yes, Jack says. She knows something. All right, Beezer says and stands up from his stool. Your choice. We'll have to talk to you afterward. Beezer, I want to be with you when you go inside Black House. Whatever we have to do in there, whatever we see. Jack pauses, trying to find the right words. Beezer is rocking on his heels, practically jumping out of his skin in his eagerness to hunt down the fisherman's lair. You're going to want me there. There's more to this business than you can imagine, Beezer. You're going to know what I'm talking about in a little while, and you'll be able to stand up to it. I think all of you will. But if I tried to describe it now, you wouldn't believe me. When the time comes, you'll need me to see you through, if we get through. You'll be glad I was there. We're at a dangerous point here, and none of us wants to mess it up. What makes you think I'll mess it up? Beezer asks with deceptive mildness. Anyone would mess it up if they didn't have the last piece of the puzzle. Go out there, see if Mouse can find the house he saw 2 years ago. Check it out. Don't go in. To do that, you need me. After you check it out, come back here and I'll see you as soon as I can. I should be back before 2:30, 3 at the latest. Where are you going in Arden? Maybe I'll want to call you. French County Lutheran Hospital, Ward D. If you can't get me, leave a message with a Dr. Spiegelman. Ward D, huh? Beezer says. Okay, I guess everybody's crazy today. And I guess I can be satisfied with only a look at this house, as long as I know that sometime this afternoon I can count on you to explain all these pieces I'm too stupid to understand. It'll be soon, Beezer. We're closing in. And the last thing I'd call you is stupid. I guess you must have been one hell of a cop, Beezer says. Even though I think half the stuff you say is crap, I can't help but believe it. He turns around and brings his fists down on the bar. Stinky Cheese, it's safe now. Drag your pale ass out of the kitchen. Chapter 19. Jack follows the Thunder Five out of the parking lot. And for the moment, we will let him go alone on his northward way on Highway 93 toward Judy Marshall's lookout and Judy Marshall's locked ward. Like Jack, the bikers are headed toward the unknown. But their unknown lies westward on Highway 35, into the land of the steadily accumulating past, and we want to know what they will find there. These men do not appear to be nervous. They still project the massive confidence with which they burst into the sandbar. In truth, they never really display nervousness, for situations that would make other people worried or anxious generally make them get physical. Fear affects them differently than it does other people, too. In the rare moments when they have experienced fear, they've tended on the whole to enjoy it. In their eyes, fear represents a God-given opportunity for focusing their collective concentration. Due to their remarkable solidarity, that concentration is formidable. For those of us who are not members of a biker gang or the Marine Corps, solidarity means little more than the compassionate impulse that leads us to comfort a bereft friend. For Beezer and his merry band, solidarity is the assurance that someone's always got your back. They are on each other's hands, and they know it. For the Thunder Five, safety really is in numbers. Yet the encounter toward which they are flying has no precedents or analogs in their experience. Black House is something new, and its newness, the sheer strangeness of Mouse's story, sinks tendrils down into their guts, one and all. 8 miles west of Centralia, where the flatland around Potsey's 30-year-old development yields to the long stretch of woods that runs all the way to Maxton's, Mouse and Beezer ride side by side in front of the others. Beezer occasionally looks to his friend, asking a wordless question. The third time that Mouse shakes his head, he follows the gesture with a backward wave of his hand that says, "Stop bugging me, I'll tell you when we're there." Beezer drops back. Sonny, Kaiser Bill, and Doc automatically assume Beezer is giving them a signal, and they string out in a single line. At the head of the column, Mouse keeps taking his eyes off the highway to inspect the right-hand side of the road. The little road is hard to see, Mouse knows, and by now it will be more overgrown than it was 2 years ago. He is trying to spot the white of the battered no trespassing sign. It, too, may be partially hidden by new growth. He slows down to 35. The four men behind him match his change in pace with the smoothness of long practice. Alone of the Thunder Five, Mouse has already seen their destination, and in the deepest places of his soul, he can scarcely believe that he is going there again. At first, the ease and rapidity with which his memories had flown out of their dark vault had pleased him. Now, instead of feeling that he has effortlessly reclaimed a lost part of his life, he has the sense of being at the mercy of that lost afternoon. A grave danger then, and he does not doubt that some great and dangerous force had brushed him with a warning hand, is an increased danger now. Memory has returned a miserable conclusion he thrust away long ago, that the hideous structure Jack Sawyer called Black House had killed little Nancy Hale as surely as if its rafters had fallen in on her. Moral more than physical, Black House's ugliness exhaled toxic fumes. Little Nancy had been killed by the invisible poisons carried on the warning hand. Now Mouse had to look at that knowledge without blinking. He can feel her hands on his shoulders, and their thin bones are covered with rotting flesh. If I'd been 5'3" and weighed 105 pounds instead of being 6'2" and 290, by now I'd be rotting too, he thinks. Mouse may look for the narrow road and the sign beside it with the eyes of a fighter pilot, but someone else has to see them, because he never will. His unconscious has taken a vote, and the decision was unanimous. Each of the other men, Sonny, Doc, the Kaiser, and even Beezer, have also connected little Nancy's death with Black House, and the same speculations about comparative size and weight have passed through their minds. However, Sonny Cantanaro, Doc Amberson, Kaiser Bill Strassner, and especially Beezer St. Pierre assume that whatever poison surrounded Black House had been concocted in a laboratory by human beings who knew what they were doing. These four men derive the old primitive reassurance from one another's company that they have enjoyed since college. If anything makes them feel a touch uneasy, it is that Mouse Bauman, not Beezer, leads their column. Even though Beezer let Mouse wave him back, Mouse's position contains a hint of insurrection, of mutiny. The universe has been subtly disordered. 20 yards from the back end of the Maxton property, Sonny decides to put an end to this farce, guns his soft tail, roars past his friends, and moves up parallel to Mouse. Mouse glances at him with a trace of worry, and Sonny motions to the side of the road. When they have all pulled over, Mouse says, "What's your problem, Sonny?" "You are," Sonny says. "Either you missed a turnoff or your whole story's all fucked up." "I said I wasn't sure where it is." He notices with nearly immeasurable relief that little Nancy's dead hands no longer grip his shoulders. "Of course not. You are ripped on acid." "Good acid." "Well, there's no road up ahead, I know that much. It's just trees all the way to the old fuck's home." Mouse ponders the stretch of road ahead as if the road just might be up there after all, although he knows it is not. "Shit, Mouse, we're practically in town. I can see Queen Street from here." "Yeah," Mouse says. "Okay." If he can get to Queen Street, he thinks, those hands will never fasten on him again. Beezer walks his electroglide up to them and says, "Okay, what, Mouse? You agree it's farther back, or is the road somewhere else?" Frowning, Mouse turns his head to look back down the highway. "God damn. I think it's along here somewhere, unless I got totally turned around that day." "Gee, how could that have happened?" says Sonny. "I looked at every inch of ground we passed, and I sure as hell didn't see a road. Did you, Beezer? How about a no trespassing sign? You happen to see one of those?" "You don't get it," Mouse says. "This shit doesn't want to be seen." "Maybe you should have gone to Ward D with Sawyer," Sonny says. "People in there appreciate visionaries."
"Can it, Sonny?" Beezer says. "I was there before and you weren't," Mouse says. "Which one of us knows what he's talking about?"
"I've heard enough out of both of you guys," Beezer says. "Do you still think it's along here somewhere, Mouse?"
"As far as I can recollect, yeah."
"Then we missed it. We'll go back and check again, and if we don't find it, we'll look somewhere else. If it's not here, it's between two of the valleys along 93, or in the woods on the hill leading up to the lookout. We have plenty of time."
"What makes you so sure?" Sonny asks. Mild anxiety about what they might come across is making him belligerent. He would just as soon go back to the sandbar and down a pitcher at Kingsland while messing with Stinky's head as waste his time goofing along the highways. Beezer looks at him and his eyes crackle. "You know anywhere else there's enough trees to call it a woods?" Sonny backs down immediately. Beezer is never going to give up and go back to the sandbar. Beezer is in this for keeps. Most of that has to do with Amy, but some of it relates to Jack Sawyer. Sawyer impressed the shit out of Beezer the other night. That's what happened. And now Beezer thinks everything the guy says is golden. To Sonny, this makes no sense at all, but Beezer's the one who calls the shots. So, for now, Sonny guesses, they will all run around like junior G-men for a while. If this adopt-a-cop program goes on for more than a couple of days, Sonny plans to have a little chat with Mouse and the Kaiser. Doc will always side with Beezer no matter what, but the other two are capable of listening to reason. All right, then, Beezer says. Scratch from here to Queen Street. We know there's no fucking road along that stretch. We'll go back the way we came, give it one more shot. Single file the whole way. Mouse, you're point man again. Mouse nods and prepares himself to feel those hands on his shoulders again. Gunning his fat boy, he rolls forward and takes his place at the head of the line. Beezer moves in behind him, and Sonny follows Beezer, with Doc and the Kaiser in the last two slots. Five pairs of eyes, Sonny thinks. If we don't see it this time, we never will. And we won't, because that damned road is halfway across the state. When Mouse and his old lady got buzzed on the Ultimate, they could go for hundreds of miles and think they'd taken a spin around the block. Everybody scans the opposite side of the road and the edge of the woods. Five pairs of eyes, as Sonny puts it, register an unbroken line of oaks and pine trees. Mouse has set a pace somewhere between a fast walk and a medium jog, and the trees crawl by. At this speed, they can notice the moss blistering the trunks of the oaks and the bright smears of sunlight on the forest's floor, which is brownish-gray and resembles a layer of rumpled felt. A hidden world of upright trees, shafts of light, and deadfalls extends backwards from the first sentinel row. Within that world, paths that are not paths wind maze-like between the thick trunks and lead to mysterious clearings. Sonny becomes suddenly aware of a tribe of squirrels doing squirrel gymnastics in the map of branches that lace into an intermittent canopy. And with the squirrels, an aviary of birds pops into view. All of this reminds him of the deep Pennsylvania woods he had explored as a boy before his parents sold their house and moved to Illinois. Those woods had contained a rapture he had found nowhere else. Sonny's conviction that Mouse got things wrong and they are looking in the wrong place takes on greater inner density. Earlier, Sonny had spoken about bad places, of which he has seen at least one he was absolutely certain about. In Sonny's experience, bad places, the ones that let you know you are not welcome, tended to be on or near borders. During the summer after his high school graduation, he and his two best buddies, all of them motorcycle freaks, had taken their bikes to Rice Lake, Wisconsin, where he had two cousins cute enough to show off to his friends. Sal and Harry were thrilled with the girls, and the girls thought the bikers were sexy and exotic. After a couple of days spent as a literal fifth wheel, or fifth and sixth wheel, depending on what you're counting, Sonny proposed extending their trip by a week, and in the interest of expanding their educations, balling the jack down to Chicago and spending the rest of their money on beer and hookers until they had to go home. Sal and Harry loved the whole idea, and on their third evening in Rice Lake, they packed their rolls on their bikes and roared south, making as much noise as possible. By 10 o'clock, they had managed to get completely lost. It might have been the beer, it might have been inattention, but for one reason or another, they had wandered off the highway, and in the deep black of a rural night, found themselves on the edge of an almost non-existent town named Harco. Harco could not be found on their gas station roadmap, but it had to be close to the Illinois border on either one side or the other. Harco seemed to consist of an abandoned motel, a collapsing general store, and an empty grain mill. When the boys reached the mill, Sal and Harry groused about being exhausted and hungry and wanted to turn back to spend the night in the motel. Sonny, who was no less worn out, rode back with them. The second they rolled into the dark forecourt of the motel, he had a bad feeling about the place. The air seemed heavier, the darkness darker than they should have been. To Sonny it seemed that malign, invisible presences haunted the place. He could all but make them out as they flitted between the cabins. Sal and Harry jeered at his reservations. He was a coward, a fairy, a girl. They broke down a door and unrolled their sleeping bags in a bare, dusty, rectangular room. He carried his across the street and slept in a field. Dawn awakened him, and his face was wet with dew. He jumped up, pissed into the high grass, and checked for the motorcycles on the other side of the road. There they were, all three of them, listing over their stands outside a broken door. The dead neon sign at the entrance of the forecourt read Honeymoon's Bower. He walked across the narrow road and swept a hand over the moisture shining black on the seats of the motorcycles. A funny sound came from the room where his friends were sleeping. Already tasting dread, Sonny pushed open the broken door. If he had not initially refused to make sense of what was before him, what he saw in the room would have made him pass out. His face streaked with blood and tears, Sal Terso was sitting on the floor. Harry Riley's severed head rested in his lap, and an ocean of blood soaked the floor and daubed the walls. Harry's body lay loose and disjointed on top of his blood-soaked sleeping bag. The body was naked. Sal wore only a blood-red t-shirt. Sal raised both his hands, the one holding his prize long-bladed knife and the one holding only a palmful of blood, and lifted his contorted face to Sonny's frozen gaze.
"I don't know what happened."
His voice was high and screechy, not his.
"I don't remember doing this. How could I have done this? Help me, Sonny. I don't know what happened."
Unable to speak, Sonny had backed out and flown away on his cycle. He'd had no clear idea of where he was going, except that it was out of Harco. 2 miles down the road, he came to a little town, a real one with people in it, and someone finally took him to the sheriff's office. Harco. There was a bad place. In a way, both of his high school friends had died there, because Sal Terso hanged himself 6 months after being committed to a state penitentiary for life on a second-degree murder charge. In Harco, you saw no red-winged blackbirds or woodpeckers. Even sparrows steered clear of Harco. This little stretch of 35? Nothing but a nice, comfortable woodland. Let me tell you, Senator Sonny Cantanaro has seen Harco, and this ain't no Harco. This don't even come close. It might as well be in another world. What meets Sonny's appraising eye and increasingly impatient spirit is about a mile and a quarter of beautiful wooded landscape. You could call it a mini-forest. He thinks it would be cool to come out here by himself one day, tuck the Harley out of sight, and just walk around through the great oaks and pines, that big pad of felt beneath his feet, digging the birds and the crazy squirrels. Sonny gazes at and through the sentinel trees on the far side of the road, enjoying his anticipation of the pleasure to come, and a flash of white jumps out at him from the darkness beside a huge oak tree. Caught up in the vision of walking alone under that green canopy, he almost dismisses it as a trick of the light, a brief illusion. Then he remembers what he's supposed to be looking for, and he slows down and leans sideways and sees, emerging from the tangle of underbrush at the base of the oak, a rusty bullet hole and a large black letter N. Sonny swerves across the road, advances 3 inches. The N expands into N-O. He doesn't believe it, but there it is, Mouse's goddamn sign. He rolls ahead another foot, and the entire phrase comes into view. Sonny puts the bike in neutral and plants one foot on the ground. The darkness next to the oak stretches like a web to the next tree at the side of the road, which is also an oak, though not as huge. Behind him, Doc and the Kaiser cross the road and come to a halt. He ignores them and looks at Beezer and Mouse, who are already some 30 feet up the road, intently scanning the trees. "Hey!" he shouts. Beezer and Mouse do not hear him. "Hey, stop!" "You got it?" Doc calls out. "Go up to those assholes and bring them back," Sonny says. "It's here?" Doc asks, peering into the trees. "What, you think I found a body? Of course it's here." Doc speeds up, stops just behind Sonny, and stares at the woods. "Doc, you see it?" Kaiser Bill shouts, and he speeds up too. "Nope," Doc says. "You can't see it from there," Sonny tells him. "Will you please get your ass in gear and tell Beezer to come back here?" "Why don't you do it instead?" Doc says. Because if I leave this spot, I might not ever be able to fucking find it again, Sonny says. Mouse and Beezer, now about 60 feet up the road, continue blithely on their way.
Well, I still don't see it, Doc says.
Sonny sighs. Come up alongside me. Doc walks his fat boy to a point parallel with Sonny's bike, then moves a couple of inches ahead.
There, Sonny says, pointing at the sign.
Doc squints and leans over, putting his head above Sonny's handlebars.
Where? Oh, I see it now. It's all beat to hell.
The top half of the sign curls over and shades the bottom half. Some antisocial lad has happened along and creased the sign with his baseball bat. His older brothers, more advanced in the ways of crime, had tried to kill it with their .22 rifles, and he was just delivering the coup de grace.
Where's the road supposed to be? Doc asks.
Sonny, who is a little troubled about this point, indicates the flat sheet of darkness to the right of the sign and extending to the next smaller oak tree. As he looks at it, the darkness loses its two-dimensionality and deepens backward like a cave, or a black hole softly punched through the air. The cave, the black hole, melts and widens into the earthen road about 5.5 feet wide that it must have been all along.
That sure as hell is it, says Kaiser Bill. I don't know how all of us could have missed it the first time.
Sonny and Doc glance at each other, realizing that the Kaiser came along too late to watch the road seem to materialize out of a black wall with the thickness of a sheet of paper.
It's kind of tricky, Sonny says.
Your eyes have to adjust, Doc says.
Okay, says Kaiser Bill, but if you two want to argue about who tells Mouse and the Bees, let me put you out of your misery.
He jams his bike into gear and tears off like a World War I messenger with a hot dispatch from the front. By now a long way up the road, Mouse and Beezer come to a halt and look back, having apparently heard the sound of his bike.
I guess that's it, Sonny says with an uneasy glance at Doc. Our eyes had to adjust.
Couldn't be anything else.
Less convinced than they would like to be, both men let it drop in favor of watching Kaiser Bill conversing with Beezer and Mouse. The Kaiser points at Sonny and Doc, Beezer points, then Mouse points at them, and the Kaiser points again. It looks like a discussion in an extremely unevolved version of sign language. When everybody has gotten the point, Kaiser Bill spins his bike around and comes roaring back down the road with Beezer and Mouse on his tail. There is always that feeling of disorder, of misrule when Beezer is not in the lead. The Kaiser stops on the side of the narrow road. Beezer and Mouse halt beside him, and Mouse winds up stationed directly in front of the opening in the woods.
Shouldn't have been that hard to see, Beezer says.
But there she is, anyhow. I was beginning to have my doubts, Mousy.
Uh-huh, says Mouse.
His customary manner, that of an intellectual roughneck with a playful take on the world, has lost all of its buoyancy. Beneath his biker's fair-weather sunburn, his skin looks pale and curd-like.
I want to tell you guys the truth, Beezer says.
If Sawyer is right about this place, the creepy fuck who built it could have set up booby traps and all sorts of surprises. It was a long time ago, but if he really is the fisherman, he has more reason than ever to keep people away from his crib. So we gotta watch our backs. The best way to do that is to go in strong and go in ready. Put your weapons where you can reach him in a hurry, all right?
Beezer opens one of his saddlebags and draws out a Colt 9mm pistol with ivory grips and a blue steel barrel. He chambers around and unlocks the safety. Under his gaze, Sonny pulls his massive .357 Magnum from his bag, Doc a Colt identical to Beezer's, and Kaiser Bill an old S&W 38 Special he has owned since the late 70s. They shove the weapons, which until this moment have seen use only on firing ranges, into the pockets of their leather jackets. Mouse, who does not own a gun, pats the various knives he has secreted in the small of his back, in the hip and front pockets of his jeans, and sheathed within both of his boots.
Okay, Beezer says.
Anybody in there is going to hear us coming no matter what we do, and maybe already has heard us. So there's no point in being sneaky about this. I want a fast, aggressive entrance, just what you guys are good at. We can use speed to our advantage. Depending on what happens, we get as close to the house as possible.
What if nothing happens? Asked the Kaiser. Like, if we roll on in there and just keep going until we get to the house. I mean, I don't see any particular reason to be spooked here. Okay, something bad happened to Mouse, but, you know, doesn't mean it's going to happen all over again.
Then we enjoy the ride, Beezer says.
Don't you want to take a look inside? The Kaiser asks. He might have kids in there.
He might be in there, Beezer tells him. If he is, no matter what I said to Sawyer, we're bringing him out. Alive would be better than dead, but I wouldn't mind putting him in a serious state of bad health. He gets a rumble of approval. Mouse does not contribute to this wordless but otherwise universal agreement. He lowers his head and tightens his hands on the grips of his bike. Because Mouse has been here before, he goes in on point. Doc and I'll be right behind him with Sonny and the Kaiser covering our asses. Beezer glances at them and says, stay about 6-8 feet back, all right?
Don't put Mouse on point. You have to go in first, speaks in Sonny's mind. But he says,
all right, Bees. Line up, Beezer says.
They move their bikes into the positions Beezer has specified. Anyone driving fast along Highway 35 would have to hit his brakes to avoid running into at least 2 beefy men on motorcycles, but the road stays empty. Everyone, including Mouse, guns his engine and prepares to move. Sonny slaps his fist against the Kaiser's and looks back at that dark tunnel into the woods. A big crow flaps onto a low-hanging branch, cocks its head, and seems to fix Sonny's eyes with its own. The crow must be looking at all of them, Sonny knows, but he cannot shake the illusion that the crow is staring directly at him and that its black, insatiable eyes are dancing with malice. The uncomfortable feeling that the crow is amused by the sight of him bent over his bike makes Sonny think of his magnum.
Turn you into a mess of bloody feathers, baby.
Without unfolding its wings, the crow hops backward and disappears into the oak leaves.
Go! Beezer shouts.
The moment Mouse charges in, little Nancy's rotting hands clamp down on his shoulders. Her thin bones press down on the leather hard enough to leave bruises on his skin. Although he knows this is impossible, you cannot get rid of what does not exist. The sudden flare of pain causes him to try to shake her off. He twitches his shoulders and wiggles the handlebars, and the bike wobbles. As the bike dips, little Nancy digs in harder. When Mouse rights himself, she pulls herself forward, wraps her bony arms around his chest, and flattens her body against his back. Her skull grinds against the nape of his neck, her teeth bite down on his skin.